see it.
All right, so this is the inaugural episode of this is the Listening Post, and I'm Alan, and we're going to get started. We're going to jump right in, we're not going to jump right in, because the first thing we're going to do is we're going to talk a little bit. I'm going to tell you why this even came into being. Over the years, I've accumulated music in various forms. I've had, we all did. We had vinyl, and then we swapped out for cassettes, and then I had 8-tracks for a while. My brother actually turned me on to Queen because he had Queen 8-tracks, and I had, what else? We went through the list, and by the early 2000s, I had amassed an external hard drive that had thousands of songs that was given to me by somebody. And it occurred to me that there were a lot of albums I had never heard, because how could you listen to everything? But I was also of the mind that with the advent of the ability to record digitally, as a band, it was a lot easier for people to make music. That's the bottom line. It was a lot easier, I thought, for people to make music and shove it into the world. And that was the end of gatekeepers and tastemakers. And basically, I had this theory that if there was X number of bands playing on X number of nights, in X number of clubs, in bars, and X number of cities, and each one of them could suddenly make an album, you had hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of albums, and that's why music was so bad. I decided to go back into the 70s, which I thought there was like the end of the album rock era, which is sort of where my awakening began. And I decided to see, was there anything I missed from those formative 13 to 15-year-old years? And I decided I would start in 1978 because that I thought 79 and 80 were great years for music. So let's just go back a little bit. Let's see what I missed. And I don't want to date myself, but because of the advent of Spotify and Apple Music and the ability to stream just about any album you wanted, you could, if you had the mind, listen to everything or just about. And I also, I'm this kind of person. I went and I found, well, it was not the most comprehensive list, but I used Wikipedia to get a list of albums released in a given year. And I would suss out. I would parse out. And there were things I was not going to do. I wasn't going to do disco and I wasn't going to do R&B. And not because I don't have any kind of affection for that kind of music, but just because I personally don't have much of a vocabulary in it. And so since it doesn't grab me and speak to me and it doesn't it wasn't formulative for me, I'd be remiss in trying to analyze it or even evaluate it. Now, of course, there'd be some that would cover that, but or flow into that. But the bottom line is I stuck with rock. And given that I was sticking with rock, I was able to listen to over the course of about 2 years, 970-odd albums. And I, made a little list and a little spreadsheet. I didn't review them. I rated them. And I stopped. That was it. I was done. And as it would happen, the election of our 45th president in the United States resulted in frustration with where this person was taking up so much real estate in my head that I couldn't focus on anything else, and it was saddening. And I did my part, I helped in local elections, and I got involved, and I would pontificate, and I made my little Facebook posts. But ultimately, once we had the election of 2018, and now there was a little bit of balance coming back to the government. It doesn't have to be fully one way or the other, but there has to be some balance. And once that happened, I found myself not wanting to give up all the real estate in my brain to politics anymore. And that seems to be whatever everybody wants to talk about is politics. And so I decided to go back to the project and just keep going. And I started delving into the music of 1983 because that's where I left off. And a few albums into 1983, I heard Duck Rock by Malcolm McLaren. And I had never heard Duck Rock before. And the first reaction I had with Duck Rock was, huh, did Paul Simon, doesn't he owe royalties to Malcolm McLaren? Because I was kind of flabbergasted at we all, I mean, I was limited, believe me, I get it. I was, you know, my limited knowledge. But of course, I have enough Dunning-Kruger to think that I know everything. And I thought that Paul Simon came out of nowhere with his African rhythms and his African sounds. And I should have known better because I was a huge, an inveterate Adam Ant fan. I'm an Adam Ant apologist. And I listened to Kings of the Wild Frontier almost to the exclusion of anything else for a period of time. And I saw Adam in concert as many times as I've seen anybody else, if not more. And so I know the story. I know the story of Malcolm McLaren. I know the story of the band kicking him out. I know the story of the introduction of the Burundi beat and Bow Wow Wow. I know that all. And I should have known better because, of course, that was bubbling under the surface. And there were bands like Talking Heads and a variety of others that were incorporating those sounds into contemporary music. But when Graceland came out, it was like a revelation, right? It was something that we all could appreciate. And in fact, the You Can Call Me Al song was the least interesting on the album. And everybody bought Ladysmith Black Mambazo's album after they appeared on Paul Simon's Graceland album. So hearing Duck Rock, I never made the connection. And then suddenly I had that revelatory moment of, wait a minute, he was there first. Or he was there earlier than Paul. And so anyway, what that resulted in is I made a little Facebook post about that. And I have some friends who also love music, my college roommate, other friends who love music. And I think we all were of the mind that the current administration is taking up way too much real estate in our heads and our conversations. And everybody's Facebook post has turned into a magazine, a curated magazine for their political identity. And that got boring. And so instead of being a respite, instead of being a place that we could escape to, Facebook had become this morass of griping and grievances. And I made that little comment out of the blue, apropos of absolutely nothing, about Duck Rock, which started a conversation. And that conversation, it was just a great thread. It was just a really great thread with people commenting about Duck Rock, Malcolm McLaren, that era of music. And somebody, a friend of mine named Sheffield, said this is the best conversation he's had in Facebook in a while. And I don't remember exactly how he put it, but that's basically what he said. And I agreed. And I decided, since I was already about, I don't know, 20 albums in to the project for 1983, that I would just start a group. I started a group. Now, I called it the Listening Post. And the reason I called it the Listening Post is I already have a blog that was called the Listening Post. And I'll get into that in another day because I've already spent 10 minutes talking about why we're here. And I'll never talk about why we're here again. Anyway, the Listening Post exists and it's on Facebook. It's a group. Right now it's called the Listening Post, the 80s. And we're currently playing the year 1984. We've completed 1983 and I'm loath to go back and re-review every album. So we're just going to start with episode one of the Listening Post podcast by jumping in and talking about the most recent reviews. Red Rockers, this band from New Orleans, came out with a follow-up to their 1983 Good as Gold album. And this album was called Schizophrenic Circus. Now, I had never heard of Red Rockers before. I had never heard, I didn't even hear the single China. And other people have. Other people remembered Red Rockers from China. But apparently they started off as a punk band. And the very first thing I thought of was, well, if Hooters could make it, how come the Red Rockers didn't? But that's because one of the first songs on the album, actually the second song, is called Blood from a Stone, which is a Hooters song. It's great, but the Hooters are going to release it the year after, and it's, you know, the Hooters show up here, they show up, one of the guys shows up as a writer of Cyndi Lauper's music the year before on her huge album, It's So Unusual. So the Red Rockers have a song that they covered by a band that had a crappy first album and was about to hit the next year. The first song has that big anthemic sound. It's called Just Like You. And then it moves into Blood from a Stone. And it all sounds very ready-made for radio. It's kind of like The Alarm. These guys want to be maybe The American Alarm or the American Clash. I don't know. But it's a little early in the era for that sort of alt-country sound, which... only a couple years later, a band like Lone Justice is going to explode with. And I saw Lone Justice when I went to see Saturday Night Live. And the reason I went to see Saturday Night Live, and you can go watch this episode, the reason I was there is because William Shatner was hosting Saturday Night Live. I guess this is 1986, and Star Trek, The Voyage Home, had just been released. And I was working in a video store, and... there was a woman who used to come into the video store named Susan. And Susan, it turned out, was Lorne Michaels' ex-wife. And I knew that she was Lorne Michaels' ex-wife somehow. And I mentioned how much I wanted to go to SNL to see William Shatner. And she got me tickets to go see myself and my manager to go see William Shatner live at SNL. In the front row. And if you go back and you watch the video, you find clips of it. Don't look for the clips of Shatner, because although he tripped on my knee, just about banged into me on his way to run to the sketch that was off audience left. And I think that was the Get a Life sketch. And that was very famous, but that on his way over banged me in the knee. But the moment that I want you to look for is when Lone Justice is playing and the camera is shooting from behind. And if you look in the front row, there's a that looks to be like a white-haired woman. I think maybe even wearing a trench coat. I have to go back and look at the video. But there's a woman in the front row, big white-haired woman. That's not a woman. That's me. I had stripped all the color out of my hair, and that's a whole other story. But that's the only evidence that I ever did that is right there on camera. Sort of. It's hard to see. So, but Lone Justice is still a couple of years away, and I don't think people were quite ready for that sound. So you've got Red Rockers sort of beginning to mine that sound, and this was around the same time The Alarm was doing it, but The Alarm was still the conduit, the bridge between what was coming with alt country and what was in the past, which was the Clash. You also the Beat Farmers, that roots rock thing was beginning to take form. But this is a little more than roots rock. This is just very alt country. But apparently, before they were this wannabe country band, Red Rockers was a punk band. And I don't think you could figure you would have any idea, given how psychedelic the garage rock of their song Another Day. And I Know Her. Psychedelic those songs actually are. And that's a shame, because those two songs are much better than their actual psychedelic garage rock cover of Eve of Destruction. And let's face it, in 1984, it's probably... In 1984, it was probably more important for people to listen to The Animals' Eve of Destruction than ever before, since the paranoia was riding really high during that era. But if you're going to listen to a cover of Eve of Destruction and you want one that has sort of the impact and the energy that is required of the paranoia of the day, then I say you go back and you listen to the Dickies version. Or the Animals. Anyway, Red Rockers album, Schizophrenic Circus, we rated it 3.5 out of 5. Album 161 of 1984 was released on June 25th, and it is an album that has a special place in my heart. It sucks, but it has a special place in my heart. It is Strange Frontier by Roger Taylor, the drummer from Queen. I have to preface talking about Roger Taylor's Strange Frontier by talking about Fun in Space. And the frustration I had, not with the album Fun in Space, but the frustration I had with the movie Bohemian Rhapsody, which, by the way, I loved. And Rami Malek was fantastic. And as I'm recording this, he's won the Golden Globe and he's won the SAG Award, but I'm not entirely, you know, he might win the Oscar. But we're not reviewing that movie, which I liked. What I want to talk about is the scene in the movie when the band is so pissed off that Freddie has signed a solo contract to record Mr. Bad Guy. And Mr. Bad Guy is awful, and we'll talk about it next year when we get to 1985, or whenever we do. But the point is, while Mr. Bad Guy is awful, and he did go off and do a solo career and was paid however much money at the time, I don't know, that all seems a little bit apocryphal. What is frustrating and annoying is their enmity and their ire at Fred for putting out a solo album. Let's just put a pin in this whole thing and say, Brian May just put out a solo album, although it was an EP. It was called Brian May and Friends, and it was the theme to a Japanese science fiction show called Starfleet. This was called the Starfleet Project. It's a theme song, and it went on forever. And I think Eddie Van Halen was on it, and it was Brian May and Friends. And I loved Brian May and Friends, which predated Mr. Bad Guy. But what also predated Mr. Bad Guy by 4 years was Roger Taylor's solo album, Fun in Space. And Fun in Space, he actually thanked, on the liner notes, the band for staying out of the way. So he puts out a solo album, which doesn't make too much of a dent, but I had it. And 4 years later, Mr. Bad Guy is released. The incongruity of those concepts were frustrating while watching the movie. Why are you so angry that he put out a solo album? You just put one out. In fact, you put out two, Roger, before Freddie put out one. And the second one you released was called Strange Frontier in 1984. So here's the thing about Strange Frontier versus Fun in Space. It's obvious, listening to Roger Taylor's oeuvre, listening to what he releases over the course of the Queen catalog, that he probably more than anybody else in the band wishes he was David Bowie. His music all has that kind of art feel, but it's also poppy. It's art pop. He dabbles in sort of electronica. He dabbles in other styles. He's an appropriator of styles, and I've always maintained that David Bowie is an appropriator of styles more than he's anything else. So that's another conversation. We'll get to that when we deal with Bowie's next album. But my theories of David Bowie, which raise other people's ire, for lack of a better word. But here's the thing about Strange Frontier. Fun in Space was Roger Taylor as David Bowie, which is odd because he's the percussionist in the band. And he's actually probably one of the most influential drummers in the history of 70s classic arena stadium rock. And his obsession was with synthesizers, which, you know, go figure. The best track on Fun in Space, again, an album that I adore, is called Let's Get Crazy, which has a drum fill in it that is currently and has been my ringtone for about 5 years. Fantastic.
Amazing.
And I'll start air drumming to that whenever it's on. But Let's Get Crazy is not on this album. On this album, for some reason, Roger Taylor decides, I'm not just going to try to be Bowie, but I'm also going to try to be Bruce Springsteen. And he includes two covers on this record. He didn't have any covers on the previous one. On this one, he has a plodding, synth-based, uninteresting cover of Springsteen's Racing in the Street. And I love Bruce Springsteen, and I love Queen, and I have a deep affection for Roger Taylor. But Roger Taylor is not Bruce Springsteen. And just because he wrote a song about being in love with his car doesn't mean that he understands the mythos of that sort of suburban car, gotta get out, gotta escape this working class life.
I got a 69 Chevy with a 396 beauty heads and a hearse down the floor. Waiting tonight down in the parking lot outside the 7-Eleven store. Me and my partner, Sonny Builder, straight out of scratch, and he rides with me from town to town. He only run for the money, got no strings attached. We set him up and then shut him down. Tonight, tonight.
So Racing in the Street doesn't work. It's because through Roger's filter, it's just a song about racing your car. And Springsteen brings so much more to his oeuvre, to his catalog, from a filter of working class. And maybe Roger Taylor was working class when he was younger. I don't think so. Maybe he was in school to become a dentist and growing up in somewhere in England. And I have a great deal of respect for him, but the two are not. This is basically a guy saying, I love that song and I want to record it. But it what fares a little bit better than Racing in the Street is the other cover on the album, which is Bob Dylan's Masters of War.
Come, you masters of war, you that build the big guns.
So,
you that build the death planes.
I don't understand. I'm looking back at the 80s, and I'm looking back especially at 1984, and we were pretty knee deep in danger. I wasn't around for the Cuban Missile Crisis, so I can't compare the two. And I was really young during the Red Crisis in the 1980s. And I don't know how close we got to nuclear Armageddon. But a lot of the music that has been released in 1984, even folk singer-songwriter like Al Stewart, who had an album called Russians and Americans, and there's a very jingoistic pro-America song on Glenn Frey's album, The All-Nighter. It really seems to be pervading the music scene, and in a way that is not just relegated to the punk world, not just in the secondary, you know, the underground bubbling market. Now it's really coming to the fore. And I think that this actually works. Masters of War is actually, it's bombastic enough in Roger's hands that it has resonance and it has impact. The rest of the album is okay. I mean, what did I write? The title track is good. You know, Strange Frontiers feels very similar to Fun in Space. And there's a nice little rocker called Man on Fire, which is the single. But it doesn't have any real heft to it. You know, all told, this is kind of a mediocre effort. And you get the sense that maybe from listening to this album, yeah, I now understand why the songs that were included from Roger on the works were so middling, because he was saving his better work, meaning not great, but saving his better work for his solo stuff. So that explains why Roger's contributions to Hot Space and the works were lesser than. So what did we rate at the Listening Post? Roger Taylor's Strange Frontier. We rated it 2.75 out of 5. Okay, so we're going to move on to June 26, 1984. And the album is called Parade. The band is Spandau Ballet. So we've listened to a lot of Spandau Ballet in our Listening Post, in my personal Listening Post experience. You know, we listened to True. We listened to, what is the name of the last one? I can't even remember. Diamond. Was that the first album? I think it was. We listened to True, and one of the things that we came to the conclusion is that Spandau Ballet sounds a lot more dangerous than they are. You know, using that the title of a concentration camp, the name of a concentration camp in your band name is very punk. It's very edgy. It's very new wave. There is nothing punk and edgy about Spandau Ballet. And it's all evident on this album, because there's some good stuff on the last one, especially on True. And those two hit singles, Gold and True, they sort of belie what I think Spandau Ballet really was, which is the Chicago of New Wave. Maybe perhaps the Casey and the Sunshine Band of New Romantics. Because Parade is disco, at its best, Parade is a disco record. The song "I'll Fly for You," right? That's all disco. They hit some other, you know. There's some energy, especially in the opening song, you know. And the Kemp brothers, they have musical chops. They definitely have musical chops. But ultimately, Spandau Ballet sounds like a dangerous band, but really it's just retro modern swing and cool. I think they probably would have been best suited to having a residency in Las Vegas. If that was a thing in 1984, that's where the Kemps wanted to be. Or maybe the house band of a late night talk show. So I could have seen them going any of those ways. As it stands, Parade looks like it's one of the last albums from the Spandaus before the Kemp brothers moved into acting, and there's good reason. It's not a bad album. It's not a great album. It's just a thing that's going to sit there. And if you like the sounds that Spandau Ballet makes, you'll have no problem with Parade. We rated it 3.5 out of 5. Okay, that's it. That was the pilot episode of The Listening Post. And I know we started late in the middle of the series because we're at the end of June in our retrospective. But we're going to go back. If this podcast, if it's something that I feel like I can do, and I know I made some mistakes, but if we can do it, we're going to go back and we're going to cover every album from number one that was issued in 1984 all the way till December 31st with a whole bunch of housekeeping in between. And by the way, I know it's not It's So Unusual. It's She's So Unusual. And Red Rocker's song is not I Know Her. It's So Good I Know Her. Good Thing. It's Good Thing I Know Her. Those are the little mistakes that I'm going to make. I'm going to keep making them. And sometimes I'm going to go back and clean it up. But I really don't want it to sound like I've dropped in something without, you know, I know there's some bad edits in there. Whatever. I'm apologizing. Now I've become a podcast apologist. A pod apologist. I'm not going to be a pod apologist. But what I am going to do is I am going to invite some guests. I'm going to set up our Twitter account, and I'm going to set up our email. You'll be able to contact us. But right now, that was the end of episode one of The Listening Post. We will cover every album released in the United States in 1984. Buckle up. Let's see it.